Mr. Fife, if you'd like to take it away.
Good. Well, first of all, I'm very grateful to Victoria for organizing this, and I'm happy to have the chance to talk with all of you. The occasion is that my book is coming out. It's paperback this week, and so it should be in the bookstores, I guess, tomorrow. And it seems that it's a good time to try to draw some additional attention to the book, because when the book first came out in hardcover back in April, we were in the middle of the presidential election, and things were actually kind of quite hot between Hillary Clinton and Obama. And so, a lot of the attention of political people was directed there. And then, of course, also the news from Iraq has turned so dramatically positive since last April. And so I think that there's an opportunity for people to revisit this question of what was the strategy in the war on terrorism, why did we go into Iraq, how did the Iraq war decision relate to the general war on terrorism strategy. And it was hard to get people to focus on that a year ago because the debate was so politicized, and also you still had a lot of people saying things like, Iraq is the worst disaster in American history, which, given the change in the news from Iraq, in particular the elections this past weekend, no sensible person is any longer describing Iraq in those kind of hysterical terms. So I think it's actually an opportune moment to try to get people to re-examine some of that history and to dismantle, I would hope, the many elements of the conventional wisdom that developed over the last 5 years, 6 years or so. Things like, Bush lied, people died, and all the companion mythologies. So, anyway, with that, I said to Victoria that I'd be very happy if on the occasion of the paperbacks coming out, we could get people who are interested in this history to revisit the book, call attention to it, and, encourage more people to focus on it. And I'll make one final point for those of you who might not know this. I feel like I have a license to shamelessly promote the book, in large part because I'm not making any money on it at all. And I donated 100% of my revenues from the book to charities that support veterans and their families. So my interest in promoting the book is purely to get the ideas out, and it's not a commercial thing on my part. But anyway, with that, I'm very happy to talk about the book, talk about Iraq, with all of you.
Okay, who would like to lead off?
I'll ask a question.
Okay.
Hi, this is Tom Winkler, blogging at Mishra. I was wondering, to what extent the Islamic doctrines of jihad, the requirement to subjugate infidels under the rule of Islamic law, had entered into your calculations of Iraq, and whether you thought the persecution of the Christians there had anything to do with the doctrine?
Well, the jihadist ideology was obviously a major issue in our analysis of the strategy for the war on terrorism. And one of the things that the Pentagon actually took the lead on was calling attention to the ideological component of the war on terrorism. And one of the things that I deal with in the book, which is a very sad story, was how it was Rumsfeld and General Myers and others at the Pentagon who over and over again, right from the beginning, right after 9/11, were emphasizing the importance of an ideological effort, a strategic communications effort, and a general strategy for countering ideological support for terrorism. And when the rest of the government wasn't doing very much in that area, we created within my office, within the policy office at the Pentagon, the Office of Strategic Influence to do work in this area. And the public affairs people in the Pentagon and the other people around the U.S. government were very unhappy with the creation of this office. Some of it was for turf reasons, and some of it was for other reasons. But one of the consequences was somebody lied to the New York Times and gave a report saying that this Office of Strategic Influence was intending to lie to foreign journalists. And the New York Times ran a front page story saying that. It caused a big imbroglio that resulted in the shutting down of this office. And as I say in the book, I don't think that the U.S. government has recovered to this day from that fiasco, because there was, every time anybody suggested creating an office to really deal with jihadist ideology in a systematic, strategic way, at the Pentagon, people would say, oh no, we're not going to have another Office of Strategic Influence problem. And that meant that the Pentagon couldn't do it, and the Pentagon was the place that kept recognizing the importance of the ideological struggle. The State Department, which was the logical place to do it, for its own institutional and cultural reasons, wasn't inclined to fight the battle that way. And they tended to think that all we needed was a public diplomacy campaign. And that's why you got all these brochures that were rather famous about, you know, rebranding America and showing how, you know, America treats its Muslims very nicely, and you know, which is a fine thing to do, but it's far short of an ideological campaign against jihadist extremism. And so anyway, I would say that, you know, one of the big deficiencies in our strategy for the war on terrorism to this day remains a serious effort to counter Islamist ideology. Now, your question was, how does that relate to Iraq? Iraq, I mean, we did not view Saddam Hussein as, you know, as pushing the, you know, that ideology. The Baathist ideology was quite different. But what we were concerned about is that Saddam was the kind of guy who, for other reasons, would likely be fighting us in the future, as he had fought us in the past, and that he might, in a future fight with us, use his connections with various terrorist groups, some of whom were jihadist extremists, and use them to hurt us. And so we were concerned about that, But obviously, the Saddam Hussein regime didn't have the same ideology that, for example, the Taliban regime had, which was, you know, much more in line with the jihadist ideology of Al-Qaeda. I hope that answers your question.
Next question.
Doug, it's Mark Finkelstein from Newsbusters Finkelblog, and I want to thank you for appearing on my Right Angle show back at the time of the hardcover publication. I want to ask you to comment on the recent Iraqi elections. I think most of us have focused simply on the fact that they occurred at all and that they seem to have gone off peacefully. I wonder if you could take it to another level and tell us what you think about, you know, in terms of what we know about the actual outcome at this stage of the elections, what the implications are for the future of Iraq.
Well, I don't yet know much about the outcome beyond what I read in the newspapers this morning, and I'm just
generally skeptical about what I read in the newspaper. So, I mean, I would withhold judgment on the substance of that until there are more official returns. But I think that the, you know, it is worth reflecting that there were elections in January 05. There were national referendum elections on the Constitution in, I believe it was October of 05, and then there were new elections, national elections under the new Constitution in December of 05, and now we have nationwide provincial elections in February of, end of January, February of 09. I mean, that's quite a series of elections for, you know, for a country that lived in, you know, under Baathist tyranny for 30 years, in a region where there are not free elections, you know, in any other Arab country. And so the idea that elections become routine in that area is a pretty significant development, and it's the kind of thing that causes, you know, I'm sure you all remember the commentary when you had the first Iraqi elections, and people were so amazed at how well they went, and apparently these recent ones went extremely well from the point of view of no violence and reasonably good participation. I mean, there were apparently administrative snafus that kept the vote somewhat limited, but it wasn't because of intimidation, it wasn't because of boycotts, and it wasn't because of fraud. And so that it's really quite an accomplishment. And you remember that what people were saying, when people were being interviewed throughout the Middle East after the first election, so I'm sure you could get similar comments now, people were saying things like, you know, we look over at the Iraqis, and if they can freely elect their leaders, why can't we? And I don't think there's any question that people throughout the Middle East have to be looking over at the Iraqis with some admiration and even envy, saying, you know, isn't it really extraordinary that they're able to, you know, select their leaders? And I think that this, you know, this has to have some effect on, you know, political attitudes throughout the region. Now, the one thing I would add, just because I know the nature of the debate on these subjects, and I want to preempt a remark that will inevitably come if we emphasize this, and that is that people will say, oh, well, this is the Bush administration, and, you know, you neocons in particular went to war because you thought you could do this grand political experiment in the Middle East that promotes democracy. And I want to emphasize that, as positive as I think this is, the elections and the possible influence it can have throughout the region, I want to emphatically say, as I said in the book, and as I think I demonstrated in the book, the people in the administration who worked on this policy and supported military action against Saddam Hussein did not do so in order to try to spread democracy by the sword. I mean, I believe the president and Rumsfeld and I and others who worked on this in the administration supported military action against Saddam not because we wanted to democratize Iraq, but because we wanted to eliminate the threat that the Saddam Hussein regime posed. But once it was clear that we were going to take military action and we were going to get rid of the Saddam Hussein regime, then clearly we had to do something to try to put the foundation in place for a new government. And we all understood that if we could lay a foundation for democratic institutions, it had, you know, the potential to be highly significant for improving politics throughout the region, and, you know, creating more representative government, and that could be a very benign thing, in the same way that Germany and Japan becoming democratic after World War II was a very benign thing for the world.
quick follow-up. You mentioned having seen some preliminary newspaper reports. I wonder, you clearly see these elections as being significant and newsworthy. I have seen nothing more than sort of passing mention of them in the television news shows that I monitor, and I wonder if you could comment on the quality and quantity of the media coverage of the election.
Well, I guess the main comment I would make there is general disappointment that highly significant but positive news from Iraq tends to get a lot less coverage than negative news. And some of this is inherent in the news industry. There's generally a preference for negative news, but some of it is also, I think, political or ideological. There were a lot of people who were strongly against the Iraq War, so strongly against it that they don't want to report anything positive coming out of Iraq because they don't want to acknowledge that anything good can come out of the war. But that's unprofessional and a disservice to the public.
Next question.
Sure. This is Mullane from RedState.com, and actually now Mullane.com, but it's a different story. I had a question. Two days ago, the LA Times put out an article regarding the apparent expansion of the rendition program under President Obama. Do you have any reaction to that, and also to apparently Human Rights Watch has apparently done a complete 180 on the subject now that it's a Democrat in office who's actually going to be pushing the policy?
I didn't see that LA Times report. So what exactly did it say?
Essentially, it indicated, hold on, I have it up. Under executive orders issued by Obama recently, the CIA still has authority to carry out what is known as renditions, secret abductions, and transfers of prisoners to countries that cooperate with the United States. Current and former U.S. intelligence officials said the rendition program might be poised to play an expanded role going forward because it was the main remaining mechanism, aside from counter missile strikes, for taking suspected terrorists off the street. There was a off-the-record comment from an Obama administration official. The legal advisors working on this looked at rendition. It is controversial in some circles and kicked up a big storm in Europe, but if done within certain parameters, it is acceptable practice. Let me call up what Human Rights Watch said about it. Obviously, back in April, as part of their arguments, they indicated that the United States government should repudiate the use of rendition to torture as a counterterrorism tactic and permanently discontinue the CIA's rendition program. As part of the article, they also got a quote from Tom Manowski, and they indicated that under limited circumstances, there is a limited place for renditions. The Washington Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think that what we're seeing on this whole subject of detainees is that the Obama team has been very interested in trying to distinguish itself from the Bush administration, and they've done so by trying to do symbolic things like announcing the shutting down of Guantanamo and changing some of the tone and vocabulary of the public statements on the subject. But when it comes to substance, I think we're going to find that there's a lot more continuity than one would have supposed given the campaign rhetoric. And I think what that reflects is that the critics of the administration have said is false about the Bush administration. The suggestions that the Bush administration was full of people who were at best indifferent and possibly even hostile to civil liberties is just false. And the fact is the administration had, the Bush administration had people who were trying to grapple seriously with extremely difficult trade-offs between civil liberties and security. And now, whenever you strike a balance between civil liberties and securities, you could have debates among reasonable people about did you strike the balance exactly correctly. But the way the public debate over these subjects has tended to go is not that the administration was striking the balance and doing it not quite correctly, but that the administration was full of people who, you know, were rubbing their hands with glee at the opportunity to destroy civil liberties in the country, which is of course nonsense. But you know, that was the prevailing view among many people. Now the Obama administration comes in, and lo and behold, even though the campaign rhetoric was quite extreme and quite deprecatory toward the Bush administration, the Obama administration now is faced with the very same trade-offs that the Bush administration was faced with, and it turns out that they're going to wind up making substantively, I think, a lot of decisions that are quite similar or even identical to the decisions that the Bush administration made. I mean, for example, you know, the rhetoric in the campaign about shutting down Gitmo suggested that they were going to shut it down and let all the people go, you know, on the first day, and then lo and behold, when President Obama comes in, he signs an order the first day, but the order that he signs says, you know, we're not going to shut it down for a year, and we still have to study what we're going to do with the people, and by the time you get all the qualifications in there, you realize that they're effectively endorsing a large part of what the Bush administration did, that in broad strokes they seem to be condemning during the campaign.
Okay, a quick follow-up on that. Do you ever expect the organized elements of the anti-war movement to acknowledge any of that?
Probably not. The organized elements of the anti-war movement are, I think, guilty of the kind of ideological frame of mind, closed-mindedness, indifference to the facts that they accuse Bush administration officials of. And my personal definition of an ideologue is somebody to whom the facts don't matter. And I think that a lot of the people who were condemning the Bush administration as ideological are themselves, you know, ideologues of the most rigid kind. And so I don't expect them to acknowledge it. But I do think, and I've seen this in the reaction to my book from various people who are anti-war people. But I've had a number of people, including students, say, you know, we have no sympathy at all with the war. We didn't like it, but we learned an enormous amount from your book and found that, you know, a lot of things that we had accepted as true are not true. And you know, what I generally say when I give speeches on the subject is I don't particularly care whether people, having read my book, change their opinion on whether the war was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. People can have whatever opinion they want on that. What I'm concerned about is whatever people's opinions are, they should be based on accurate information. And there are so many people in America whose opinions on the war are based on grossly inaccurate information. And I think it's just extremely important to straighten the record out. And now, if after the record gets straightened out, people change their basic opinions, you know, that's another question. I am sincerely less interested in that than I am in correcting what I think are the gross factual distortions that people made of the record of the policymakers on Iraq. I mean, people attributed wrong motives to us. They you know, there are a whole list of mythologies that I have at the beginning of the book that I, you know, make it clear are just not going to survive the opening of the record, and my book is the beginning of the opening of the record, because I grew very heavily on documents, and I hope that other people are going to come out with books in the coming years that are going to make it clear that a large part of what the anti-war people said about the Iraq War is false.
Doug, if I actually could follow up a little bit on that point, to angle it a little bit, I don't necessarily think that everyone on the staff of the New York Times and the Washington Post is per se part of the anti-war movement, but yet they are so clearly committed to that narrative. And I was going to ask you, in a more flip fashion, if you intended to send them a paperback copy of the book. But do you have any further reflections on the editorial decision?
I understand why you're asking that.
Yeah.
It's when you see the paperback, you'll see that at the very top of the cover it says a New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, which I think is funny irony given that both the New York Times and the Washington Post refused to review the book. And I mean, it became a bestseller anyway, but I think the point is correct that there are people who were so deeply invested in their narrative that is actually inaccurate in lots of respects, that they didn't want to deal with the book. Because, you know, my book is a major challenge to the accuracy of the common narrative of the opponents of the war. And, you know, it challenges the idea that the intelligence was manipulated. It challenges the false assertion that post-war planning was not done. It challenges the idea that the State Department had a plan that the Defense Department threw out. It challenges the notion that the Defense Department was plotting to anoint Chalabi as the leader of Iraq, and on, and these key elements of the now widespread mythology about the war. And something that I think is really noteworthy is that my book came out in April, and as we know, the blogosphere is full of people who are quite intensely interested in this whole subject. And even though the book is fairly lengthy and absolutely full of factual assertions, and has been out now since April, nobody has produced a criticism of the book that has challenged the accuracy of the facts that I presented. In other words, there's been nothing like the kind of exposure that you get, you know, when journalists or politicians have sometimes, you know, misstepped, and then the blogosphere jumps on the misstep and demonstrates the falseness of what was said. I mean, despite all of the passions about Iraq, and despite the incentives that people had to, you know, come after me and attack the book, from the point of view of accuracy, there isn't, as far as I'm aware, a single attack on the book that says it's inaccurate. I mean, there are people, lots of people who chose to ignore it, and there, you know, are people who choose to characterize it sweepingly and, you know, will denounce it and say, well, you know, it's just, you know, what would you expect from a neocon? You know, name-calling. But nobody has actually said that anything that I said in the book is not substantiated or is inaccurate. And I put some challenges in the book where I said, for example, that there's this widespread view that the Pentagon was essentially conspiring to put Chalabi in place to run Iraq. I said, I'm not aware of a single piece of paper that would support that conspiracy theory, even though it was widely believed even within the U.S. government. And part of the reason it's so widely believed in the press was that people within the U.S. government told journalists that that's what we were doing. And I said, we weren't doing it, it's false, and we couldn't possibly have a conspiracy of that kind without a single piece of paper that reflects it. And I basically challenged people, you know, if anybody knows, I said, I don't know what's in every file cabinet in the Pentagon, but I know that I never came across any paper like that, and there were no high-level papers that supported that view. It was not our view. And what's interesting is, you know, here we are, many months after the book originally came out, and nobody has produced, you know, any paper to support that conspiracy theory. And yet the conspiracy theory remains widely believed.
Next question.
Doug, this is Paul Marigoff. Thanks for doing this call with us. I wonder whether you have anything to say about the conventional wisdom on the conservative side and how that fares up, which I would describe that conventional wisdom as being that Secretary Rumsfeld's approach after the successful invasion was, you know, was inadequate, that we didn't come down hard in Fallujah the first time, that we didn't come down hard enough on Qaeda, al-Sadr, or whatever his name is, and that we generally let the situation slip, and it was only much later with the revision of the strategy to represent the surge that things really started to turn around. To what extent do you buy into that narrative?
Well, that's that actually is a fascinating subject that I think runs the risk of giving rise to some important wrong lessons. Because you're right, there are some very thoughtful conservatives who have been addressing the subject, and I think saying some things that are not quite right, but could be very influential for the future about the lessons that we should, you know, learn from the success of the surge. What I would say is that, I mean, first of all, let me say, no sensible person would say that everything that was done in Iraq was right. I mean, not before we launched the war, not in the immediate aftermath of Saddam's overthrow. I mean, there are lots of things that can be criticized, and my book, in fact, criticizes various things that that we did and that the administration did, and not just other agencies, but also the Pentagon and also my own office. So, I mean, there certainly are plenty of things that can properly, legitimately be criticized, including, for example, the, you know, the amount of autonomy that Ambassador Bremer wound up having, so that he essentially was not reporting through a clear chain of command back to Washington. There were problems in building up security forces after we overthrew Saddam, partly because there were disputes between the CPA and CENTCOM on you know, how to build up those security forces and whether they should be built up through increases in American forces or rapid training of Iraqi forces. Anyway, there were a number of serious problems. But if I understood the thrust of your question, Paul, what I would say about that is there is a view that you sometimes hear people express that I think is wrong, that the surge was the right policy, and if we had only adopted that surge policy several years before, we wouldn't have had the problems in Iraq that we had. Now, that, I think, is possibly a very dangerous conclusion to draw. And the reason is this. When people talk about the surge, they're actually talking about a multi-part phenomenon. And the surge was a lot more than the increase in the number of U.S. forces in the country and the new operational concepts that were developed, for example, for the way we patrolled. I mean, one of the key things that happened in the surge was we took people who were patrolling areas of Baghdad, for example, in vehicles, and we got them to go down from their vehicles, walk around in the neighborhoods, and in fact,
instead of patrolling and then after the patrol is over retreating to their bases, we had people going into the neighborhoods, dismounting, walking around, and even sleeping in the neighborhoods. Now, that is a strategy that in fact created enormous risk for our forces. Because had they dismounted and stayed in the neighborhoods at a time when the population was still quite hostile to us and cooperative with Al-Qaeda, our people might have been killed in very large numbers. But what happened that was crucial to the success of the surge was the Sunni tribal leaders in Iraq, who had been in strategic alliance with the jihadists, with the Zarqawi and the other foreign jihadists, turned against Al-Qaeda. And they, having been in bed with Al-Qaeda for a number of years, these tribal leaders decided that they didn't like their bedmates. They didn't like the goals, and they didn't like the tactics of the Al-Qaeda people. And they turned against them, and they wanted to get rid of their domination of the Sunni areas. And the thing that was so brilliant about the surge was not simply that it was more forces and different operational concepts, but it was those new developments at the right time. And what I think is extremely important is that people understand that the same changes, you know, the increase in forces and the new operational concept done at the wrong time would not have produced the good results. And, you know, one of the things that bureaucracies like simple rules, and bureaucracies don't like risk. And, you know, if a bureaucracy can come up with a rule that allows it not to have to exercise judgment, then they're very happy with that. Well, it would be a very dangerous thing to say that the particular tactics that were used that made the surge a success are always the right tactics, no matter what the circumstances. That would be a very bad lesson to draw. The thing that was brilliant about the surge was it was the right thing to do at that moment, given this extremely important change in the strategic situation when the Sunni tribal leaders were ready to reverse the strategy they had pursued for years of cooperation with Al-Qaeda and attacks on the Americans. When those Sunni tribal leaders decided to get rid of Al-Qaeda and cooperate with the Americans, that was the right moment for the surge. And I don't think it's a fair criticism of, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld, for example, to suggest that had that surge policy been adopted in 2004, it could have had the good results in 2004 that it had in 2007. Because the fact is, it took the Sunni tribal leaders several years of being in strategic alliance with Al-Qaeda for them to sour on their partners and decide to turn against them. And they were not ready to do that in 2004.
What were the things? I mean, were the things we could have done during between 2004 and 2007 that would have aided that? Would a more compelling show of force, for example, have influenced the Sunni tribal?
Well, I think. I do think that there, as I said at the beginning, there are things that I look back on and wish we had done differently. So the argument that I just made is not an argument that everything was done right. I think we made a number of mistakes. As I say in the book, the single largest mistake we made was having a prolonged occupation of Iraq, which was not in line with our original plan. I mean, it was basically what the State Department was pushing for. But the president had decided to have a liberation strategy rather than an occupation strategy, and the plan that the Defense Department had developed, which the president had approved, would not have had a U.S. occupation government for 14 months. And yet we wound up having an occupation government for 14 months, and I think it was extremely costly. I think the had we had a more rapid development of larger numbers of security forces after we overthrew Saddam, we would have been better off. And, I mean, there were debates whether we should get those additional forces from the United States, from the Iraqis, or from coalition partners. And we wound up, for various diplomatic and bureaucratic reasons, getting them from none of those three sources. So we didn't have as many forces early on as we might have. There's also the argument that we should have moved against Sadr earlier. I relate in my book the fact that that was a difficult call because it was not entirely clear that Sadr was going to become the large phenomenon that he later became. And every time somebody proposed moving against him, there was a serious weighing of costs and benefits, the risks of moving against him and turning him into a much larger phenomenon, versus the possible benefits of putting him out of our misery. And now what ultimately happened is we didn't move against him. He did become a phenomenon of some importance for quite a while, but I mean, he eventually became much less powerful and was quite successfully undermined by a combination of what the United States did in the area and what the Iraqi officials did throughout the South. And so, but again, one can easily imagine, somebody making a pretty strong argument that, we would have been better off in 2004 or even late 2003 moving against Sadr. There are a number of things that, one can go back and look at with regret in the way we handled our political work, our economic reconstruction work, and our military work in Iraq. And I'm sure there are going to be lots of books examining that for a long time to come. But I think that what would be useful is if we move away from some of the highly simplistic, highly political attacks on administration policy and get, more into the serious, fact-based, analytical criticisms from which, people can derive really useful operational lessons learned.
Well, thank you, Doug.
And just to sort of finish up that line of inquiry, do you have any reflections on the forthcoming Bowen report, the IG's report that's, I guess, titled Hard Lessons?
Yeah, I just looked it over this morning. I had talked to Bowen a number of times, and he interviewed me along with a long list of other people. And when I looked over his report, I mean, I think what struck me was that there are a number of insights in there, and I think, interesting and sensible things, but they're combined with a number of points that I think are inaccurate, not well analyzed, incorrect, simplistic, and just generally wrongheaded. So, I mean, the report is a mixed bag of useful and not useful stories and observations and lessons. I mean, one of the big problems in the report is that it lacks an understanding of the difference between a substantiated factual discussion of Iraq policy and what people years after the fact say, often in a very self-serving way. So, I mean, for example, the Inspector General, Stuart Bowen, will quote Colin Powell making statements that
has no support. I know it's, you know, this is Colin Powell talking 5-6 years after the fact, saying that Powell thought something or predicted something, and he just takes at face value the statement that was made 5-6 years after the fact to make Powell look prescient. And he doesn't say, well, I mean, if you said that 5 or 6 years ago, do you have a memo that shows that you said that? That you warned about that? I mean, one of the things, for example, that's in there, I don't remember if this is specifically Powell, but I mean, there's a discussion, for example, of the decision to dissolve the Iraqi army. Now, at the time that the Iraqi army was formally dissolved by Bremer, the position that Bremer took, which is that it would be a lot harder to try to reconstruct the Iraqi army and then reform it, and that given that the Iraqi army had essentially dissolved itself, we were better off recognizing the dissolution and starting from scratch and creating a new Iraqi army. That was a position that was not anywhere near as controversial at the time as it became years later. And, you know, what happens is now there are all kinds of people who are claiming to have seen that as a gigantic error at the time. But I can tell you that at the time, you didn't hear much criticism of that proposal. Now, there were some people who were critical, but not many, and certainly not the leadership of the State Department. But Bowen tells the story as if the people who are claiming years after the fact to have been skeptical or opposed to that decision were actually skeptical and opposed at the time. And it's just not the case. And Bowen just doesn't seem to understand the difference between a self-serving after-the-fact statement and evidence. And he takes a lot of what he learned in interviews with people at face value without asking if there's any underlying proof of what the people said in those interviews. And so I found a lot of things that are in the report, that things that I was familiar with, are not accurate. But they're probably going to, you know, and I think it's harmful that, you know, the Inspector General is considered, you know, a credible source. And what he does is, you know, he, I think, reinforced some inaccurate conventional wisdom in a lot of ways. Now, at the same time, some of what's in the report is pretty good and actually has some insight. But it's not a very rigorous job.
Do you know when it's going to be released?
Well, I saw it this morning. It came.
Okay.
It's on. I think it came out today.
Okay. I had seen it. There was an article in the Post on it this morning, and I just didn't know if the report had been released yet.
Yeah. I got it on the internet this morning, and the text is a PDF file that's available.
Okay.
The candidate Obama campaigned on the theory that the Bush administration took its eyes off of the ball, let itself get distracted in Iraq, whereas the real front in the war on terrorism was Afghanistan and by extension Pakistan, and was, and if I understand correctly, continues to be proposing, in essence, a surge in Afghanistan, whereby we'd send perhaps another 30 to 35,000 additional troops. I'd like to ask you generally to comment on that, and then specifically, do you see a bona fide mission for an additional 30,000 troops in Afghanistan? And if so, is that because there is currently, is it timely for us to do, in essence, a surge in Afghanistan in the same way that it was timely in 2007 in Iraq, but perhaps not a few years earlier? Or is it always appropriate to increase the number of troops in Afghanistan and just mean to keep our eyes off the ball?
Well, I don't think that the problem was that that we took our eyes off the ball. I mean, I think that there was substantial high-level attention to Afghanistan throughout. And I mean, the U.S. government has to do a lot of things simultaneously in its national security policy. And I mean, the notion that the government, you know, can't chew gum and walk at the same time is not correct. And there were problems in Afghanistan, but I don't think it was because, you know, people forgot that there was an effort underway there when they turned their attention to Iraq. As for the question now about whether it makes sense to increase our effort, one thing that I think is quite important, which gets very little attention in the American public discussion of Afghanistan, is that this mission in Afghanistan was turned over to NATO. I mean, the Bush administration got beaten up extremely badly by people who said that the administration was a bunch of unilateralists, people who preferred to do things in the world by ourselves without using our allies and our partners, and we did not use multilateral institutions like the UN or NATO, and you know, that became the popular image of the Bush administration. But it was never a correct criticism. And one thing that belies it is that the administration turned to NATO in Afghanistan and said, you know, here we have a major opportunity. The war in Afghanistan was not controversial. I mean, the overthrow of the Taliban was widely supported and supported throughout the NATO alliance. And here we have a tremendous opportunity for NATO as a major multilateral institution to show what it can do, to demonstrate that it has relevance, you know, after the Cold War, that NATO was not just a Cold War institution. And Afghanistan was the first out-of-area substantial operation that the alliance agreed to do. And what we find over and over and over again is that our allies have been under-investing in the resources for this operation, which is really unfortunate. And it's particularly interesting that General Jones, who's now the Obama National Security Advisor, was the U.S. European commander for years during the Bush administration, and he was the guy who was trying to get our NATO allies to provide resources to make a success of NATO's obligations, operations in Afghanistan, and he was going around trying to beg, I mean, literally 2, 3, 4 helicopters from an alliance that has, in Europe, thousands of helicopters and other aircraft, and he was trying to get literally 2, 3, or 4 helicopters to be sent into Kabul, you know, to help the NATO operation there, and found that it took months to try to extract resources of that kind. Another problem that NATO had was not only did they under-resource their commitment there, and by the way, Secretary Gates has been complaining about that in the news, you know, over recent months quite loudly, so it's an ongoing problem. But NATO also, when it sent forces to Afghanistan, would put those forces under rules of engagement that were so restrictive that it essentially precluded the forces from fulfilling, you know, a useful function. I mean, they would say things like, you know, if the forces come under attack, the forces should retreat as quickly as possible to their base. And it didn't even say, if the forces come under attack, they should fight back. And so those were the kinds of rules of engagement that some of our NATO allies put their contributed forces under. And so what's happened is, you know, where the administration has actually done what many of its critics say it should have done more of, which is, you know, a major multilateral effort, we find that, you know, the multilateral effort was not as successful as it might have been, and remains, you know, much more constrained and less successful than it should be, in part because, you know, multilateralism is not, you know, is not the panacea that that some people suggest and actually make some things quite hard. By the way, I want to make it clear, I am not against trying to give NATO these responsibilities, and I'm not against a multilateral approach when it's sensible. I just think it's an important point to make that people who just automatically think that a multilateral approach is better than a more unilateral U.S. approach, I mean, a lot of those people don't pay any attention to the real-world consequences of trying to get multilateral institutions, whether they're an alliance like NATO or an organization like the UN, to actually do a job and invest in it properly and do it with seriousness of purpose and get the job done. So I think that, you know, we do have problems in Afghanistan, and a lot of those problems right now are, you know, related to the fact that that we're not getting all the resources that we need. And a lot of the people who are suggesting that the United States needs to surge are saying that without any reference to the fact that, I mean, if there really should be a surge, it shouldn't just be U.S. I mean, if this thing were done right, and if our NATO allies were participating as they should, the idea of the surge would not necessarily involve all the extra U.S. forces that are being talked about. It should, you know, it should be something that's shared alliance-wide.
But do you have an opinion on whether or not the surge is a good idea? And if so, should the Bush administration have been urging such a surge, be it unilateral or multilateral?
Well, I guess I would... I don't have a definite answer to that question because it depends on a lot of facts that if I were in the government, I'd be asking lots of questions to get the factual situation clear as to whether you actually need more forces or whether the problem is something else. One of the things that I would highlight as a gigantic problem that the surge doesn't necessarily solve or even mitigate is the problem of safe haven in Pakistan. And it's extremely hard to fight a war and insurgency when the enemy can secure itself by, you know, crossing the border. And the Taliban and Al Qaeda, partners of the Taliban, have been able to get extremely valuable refuge in the northwest frontier area of Pakistan. And, you know, now we have a new government in Pakistan, and, you know, there's a question of, is that a real opportunity to, is that a real opportunity to get the Pakistanis to crack down harder than they did under Musharraf to prevent that territory from being used as a base for operations against Afghanistan. And, you know, I would certainly want to be pursuing that to the full before I would just automatically decide that additional U.S. forces in Afghanistan is the answer.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Hi, this is Fausta Words. I write up Fausta's blog. One question on also the allies of NATO. Even when you have capable troops like the British, a lot of their equipment is outdated or cannot be used. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, in general, I would say we have a very strong interest in having a capable alliance. So the criticisms, I just want to make it absolutely clear, and I hope that if any of you are going to report on my criticisms of NATO, it doesn't come out sounding anti-NATO.
No, I understand.
I mean, I think that NATO is a good thing, and it's worth preserving, and we should be working with our NATO allies. I say this, you know, with a lot of regret. I'm not saying this as I am not a unilateralist. I think that you'd have to be a fool to be a unilateralist. We are much better off having very capable allies and partners around the world with whom we can work on projects of common strategic interest. but I say with a lot of regret that it's often disappointing working with the Allies. Part of the reason for what you just described, you know, the phenomenon that equipment, our Allies' equipment is outdated and the like, or doesn't exist in large enough quantities, is that the Allies are, in general, grossly underinvesting in their own defense. I mean, there's a very serious free rider problem where, you know, our allies fall back on the idea that anything that really needs to be done to protect the common interests of the alliance are going to be done by the United States, no matter, you know, how much they skimp on their own defense contributions. And that's an extremely difficult problem to deal with, but it's a very harmful, it's a very harmful phenomenon. And by the way, this is a problem in NATO that goes back decades. This is not a problem that just arose during the Bush years. And one of the things that I would emphasize is that it's a very small step from non-responsibility to irresponsibility. And what happens is when our allies choose not to invest in their own defense, and they don't in fact have the capability to exercise responsibility, they become, as I said, non-responsible. You know, they have this sense, we can't affect anything, we just don't have the resources to do it. And then, as I said, it's a very small step from their having the sense that they're not really responsible for anything to becoming absolutely irresponsible in the way they talk about what we do in the world. And some of our allies, you know, instead of having real responsibility, it's a little bit like, you know, the difference between what the Obama people were saying in the campaign and what they now say, now that they have real governmental responsibility. What they said in the campaign was in many ways irresponsible, but when they come into authority, they all of a sudden have much more nuance and much more care in their statements, and they wind up endorsing things that they seem to be condemning during the campaign. Well, it works similarly with our allies. When our allies actually don't have the resources to function in a truly responsible way, they talk the way candidates do in a campaign, but they don't have real responsibility. And that's not healthy. It's not, you know, it's not the way the alliance should function. And I hope that the Obama administration, with all the goodwill that it has come into office with, can use that goodwill to encourage our allies to become, a lot more responsible and build up their capabilities to actually be able to deploy forces in the right numbers to do important missions. Because right now, you know, it's a serious problem, and it would be a shame if NATO fails in Afghanistan and it confirms the views of people who say that NATO's reason for being ended with the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Which is something that I don't agree with, and I would really regret, you know, if that view becomes more widespread. But I think it will become more widespread if NATO, you know, fails in its mission in Afghanistan. Anyway, I think I've enjoyed this talk, and I don't want to impose on everybody's time. So I would just say, you know, thank you very much for getting together for the chat, and I hope that this is of some use to you and of interest, and I hope that you'll be able to direct attention to the fact that the book is now out in paperback, and I'm particularly hopeful that because it's out in paperback, more universities can assign it. My publisher says that, you know, it's very hard for universities to assign books that are hardcover because of the expense, but, you know, now that the book is out in paperback, I hope that more universities will make use of it, and they can use it in courses that deal either with, you know, Iraqi history or courses that deal with things like civil-military relations or government policy making, and I hope it will help create
more accurate public debate on these subjects.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all very much, and I'll get this file downloaded and circulated to you in the next hour or so.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you, Victoria. Thank you, Victoria, in particular.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug.
Bye-bye.